The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition today. I know Jim's got for us a, I don't know if you call it a question, but he doesn't really have a question, but a recommendation from a listener about a topic related to a previous show that we did. We did a show about someone who was curious about our recommendations if they had almost all of their money in non-qualified accounts, which are those non-retirement accounts, so typical brokerage accounts, bank accounts, etc., where you have to deal with cost basis and dividends and interest and things going on, a lot of moving parts in those types of accounts. But Jim had a recommendation for someone to deal with a different scenario. So Jim can describe what this person was curious about.
Okay. Good morning. Actually, good afternoon, Chris. So we do have an EDU show, kind of a sister show, I guess you could say, to an EDU show we did earlier this year where someone, as Chris just said, had nearly all their money, which was a unique situation, they admit it, but they had nearly all their money in what we call maybe taxable accounts. Because you may pay taxes when you take money out of those accounts, you may not pay taxes. I know the industry calls them taxable accounts. That really irks the heck out of me because it implies every distribution is taxable. It's not. Some of the distribution is going to be basis. Some may be capital gains that could be offset with capital losses. So you may pay taxes, you may not pay taxes. I like to call them maybe taxable. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know Chris and I kind of explain things, complex things. We hope to explain in very easy to understand terms. So I came up with always taxable, maybe taxable, and never taxable accounts. Never taxable being Roth, maybe being bank and brokerage, and always taxable accounts being retirement style, what Chris called qualified accounts. That's more of an industry term because they quote unquote qualify for special tax treatment. That tax treatment is tax deferral. So you'll hear the industry sometimes call them tax deferred accounts. I like to call them always taxable because when money comes out of them, the vast, vast, vast majority of the time, it's always going to be taxable. And it's always going to be subject to income taxes. It's the worst kind of taxes. And we spoke about that before because the IRS considers those accounts income with respect to a decedent, IRD. You heard us talk about that all the time. You do-it-yourselfers at Vanguard, you Vanguardians out there, which is probably 90% of our audience. You have money in your retirement accounts. You still consider them assets. I keep trying to get you to consider them what they truly are, deferred income subject to income taxes. And when it comes to tax planning, you have to plan around reducing income, not reducing capital or capital gain. So anyways, Chris, this listener reached out to us not too long ago, relative speaking, early May. So that's not too bad. What is it now? September? No, it's not September. Well, almost September.
Almost.
It's July has just flown by.
It's flown totally gone August. 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me. August has really flown by, hasn't it?
I agree with. I didn't realize it was already in the 20s.
It's just, yeah, where the heck did it go? You know, when we get older, time goes by faster. Have you noticed that?
I've heard that, yeah. Some weeks go faster than others. Weeks go super fast.
Yeah, vacations go fast. Weekends go fast. But I swear when I was a kid, it took forever for my birthday to get here or Christmas, mm-hmm. The two most important days in a kid's life. And it took forever. Now, my God, feels like Christmas was just yesterday. But, man, time flies. Okay, anyways. So he reached out to us in early May. And he wrote a nice email. And I thought this would make a good EDU topic. He kind of has the mirror opposite of the other listener. So let me read his email because it will help put things in context for everyone. It begins... Hi, Jim and Chris. My wife and I are, I believe, in a more typical situation of having most of our retirement assets in tax-deferred accounts. I was hoping you could address those accounts and the Secure Act and any planning opportunities for the rest of us. Below is our specific situation for context. And I will share with you folks in the first paragraph, which I skipped over, he explained how he had listened to the show where someone had all their money in maybe taxable accounts, and he feels it's more representative of our listeners for people who have most of it in always taxable accounts. Okay, so he begins in his description. I am 58 and my wife is 57. We are both already retired. We have two young adult children. We have approximately $4.5 million in 401ks and traditional IRAs, about evenly split between the two of us. We also are receiving lump sum pension payouts under a 5-year period certain payout. These payouts will add another $3 million to our IRAs over the next 4 years. This money will also be evenly split between us. So all total, Chris, they have about $7.5 million when everything is said and done in always taxable accounts. Follow that so far?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Okay. Prior to the Secure Act being passed, our intent was to do Roth conversions beginning when we retire in 2020, up to the 24% tax bracket. This bracket will be 28% when the Tax Cut and Job Act expires. Now, for those who don't know, you should know, but in case you don't know, the Trump tax cuts that they're often referred to are scheduled to expire January 1st, 2026. Now, if the Biden administration, if they get in, if Biden gets elected, there is talk that they want to have indicated that they want to get rid of the tax cuts even sooner. I don't know if a lot of that is hyperbole or if it's really going to happen. And then there's talks that if the Trumpster stays in, he would extend the tax cuts or try to get it through Congress and extend them past 2026. But for all intent and purposes, January 1st of 2026, we go back to the old tax rules, which will bring back the AMT in force for a lot of you do-it-yourself listeners, and it's also going to increase tax brackets. As this listener pointed out, the 24 bracket today will be 28% when that happens. Okay. Where do we have this? So he wanted to do conversions, Chris, up to the 24 and then up to the 28 between now and when my RMDs kick in. RMDs, folks, are now age 72. And with him being 58, he's got 14 years of conversions that he was going to do trying to fill in the 24/28 tax bracket. Even doing all these conversions, though, our tax-deferred accounts, again, what I call, folks, always taxable accounts, would remain quite sizable considering our expected retirement expenses and spending from those accounts, and a projected return, which I think is reasonable, of 6%. So I am definitely going to proceed with my Roth conversion ideas, but could you and Chris also address other strategies? Perhaps SGUL policies. Do you want to explain what those are, Chris? Because he just says SGUL.
Well, that means a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy. The guaranteed means that the premiums levels are guaranteed, the death benefit. The UL, universal life, means it's a form of permanent life insurance, so it could be kept permanently. It doesn't expire like term insurance. Although most universal life, what's the top age now on universal life? There is technically
a ceiling.
You can
design a policy up to 121.
Yeah, so there technically is a limit, but it's not like a term policy where you get it for a fixed 10-year, 15-year period, etc. And second to die means there's two people on the policy that are insured, and the policy doesn't pay out the death benefit until the second, doesn't matter in what order they go, but it's the second person who passes. And this is designed as a tool that a lot of people use for guaranteeing an inheritance amount that can be received income tax free under current law by the beneficiaries at the time. And by having both lives, both spouses on the policy, it allows the lowest premium to be paid for that type of guaranteed universal life. Having two lives on there actuarially reduces the cost of the insurance to that the insurance company is providing. And so the premiums are usually minimized for this style of insurance. There's lots of different types of insurance, of course, but we're talking about this style of insurance. And that's basically it in a nutshell. And it's not a magical way to avoid RMDs. This isn't in and of itself a way to avoid RMDs, but it is in and of itself a way to pass a dollar amount on to beneficiaries without the income tax nightmare that might exist with passing on to them these always taxable accounts he's referring to. So in this case, it would be a way to maybe have the insurance policy pay the taxes for the recipient or the beneficiary, but they wouldn't have to use it for that. But that would be maybe a parallel approach you could use the proceeds from the life insurance policy to help them pay the taxes, which might be enormous if they leave them millions of dollars in always taxable and there's no ability for them to stretch the IRAs out as beneficiaries due to the changes from the Secure Act.
Exactly. Okay, so he mentions that. Then he says, how about naming heirs as partial primary beneficiaries of our retirement accounts? I'll address that. We've spoken about that on prior shows. And then he mentions, or should we consider accelerated gifting to enable our children to supercharge their own Roth IRAs or Roth 401ks? And how about the use of term insurance policies rather than a SGUL? Could that be an effective strategy to deal with an early death, which would be temporary while we're executing our Roth conversions? Too many moving parts here. Much appreciation to you both. Don't ever stop what you are doing. And we will call him George, and he's from California. So did you hear that last sentence?
Just officially, I will stop doing this at some point.
I'm just saying. Perhaps.
Now hopefully we can pass the baton on to someone else who will continue in our memory at some point.
Yes. But, Chris, just so all our listeners know, Chris and I are not doing this forever. You know what's funny? When I first started doing this, Chris, you know I used to be a police officer. And I knew I wasn't going to be a cop forever. By 6-7 years into my law enforcement career, I realized, man, this job isn't all it's cracked up to be at times. And I was really looking forward to getting out. Now, of course, with everything going on, I can't even imagine the men and women in blue. It's just, God, I couldn't even imagine still being a police officer. But that's neither here nor there. When I got into financial planning, I used to think, and I started getting into this when I was 36, 37, I thought I would do this forever. It's funny. And just, I know now I'm not going to. So both Chris and I do have an idea of exiting from this as a career, probably for me about 10 years from now. So it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow, but I'm not going to do it forever. But I would entertain doing a podcast or whatever is around in the future, even in retirement, because I enjoy this. And I joke with Chris a lot, listeners, about wanting to do a third and fourth show. I think I might be softening him on the third show,
no.
Listeners. I can't, no, still not softening no. you. But we're still trying, listeners. But someday he and I will retire and we will be passing our practice on. We're not closing it down. We're not just going to sell it and walk away. We will be passing it on to younger folk who eventually have to take over. I mean, that's the way of life, Chris. You got to move on and younger people step in. That just is what happens. Okay. And I did smile when he said, don't ever stop doing what you're doing. This from a man who's 58 and already retired. So I do want to point that out to him. He stopped doing whatever he was doing.
Right.
And he was obviously doing it quite well because he's very successful. But even he stopped. So eventually people will stop. All righty. I thought this was a good question because we can run with it in a few directions. We've probably spoken about many of the things in the past shows, but we'll try to tie them up into one show. I do like some of his thoughts, a few of his questions. And the key to remember, whether it's this listener or other listeners, I now have to assume his concern, because he mentioned the Secure Act, is passing his assets on to his young adult children. Remember, folks, he has two children. He has 95% of his assets in always taxable accounts. Today, it's $7.5 million. He's only 58. If he lived 30 more years to 88, that $7.5 million, even with RMDs, could be quite substantial. He's assuming a 6% on average return. Is that reasonable? Might be a little high. I don't know. I was just reading an article recently, Chris, in Advisor Perspectives, and it pointed out that the S&P since 2000 is up only 3.87% over the past 20 years. So you look at that, and it's very easy with the more recent equity market performance over the past 5 and 10 years into thinking, oh, I can easily get 6%. But if you look at it over the last 20 years, it's barely made 4. So I don't know if 6% is reasonable or not, listener. You might get that, you might get more, you might get less. But it is reasonable, I think, Chris, to assume $7.5 million, even with required minimum distributions, will grow to a substantial amount of deferred income, because that's what it is. That $7.5 million of deferred income could grow quite large. Are you on the same page with there? Or do you want to?
Yeah, and one thing I do want to mention, he talked about right up front, and I'm not saying in his case this would necessarily be addressing his concerns. But I think he made a comment that is common thought for people, that you can't do Roth conversions after RMD age. So I want to, you know, cut through that right now and say that's not true. The only thing that you run into is that the first distributions from the account must be the RMD. So you have to satisfy the RMD before you can do the conversion. But I've seen a number of cases where it makes perfect sense for people to continue doing conversions after RMD age. So I'm not saying in his case, I just want, we hear it so often that I think people have somehow come to the conclusion you can't do conversions after RMD age. And it could be tougher in as there's a lower percentage of people where it makes sense, but it sometimes does. So just know you can do it.
Exactly. And with a good tax plan, you could lay that out and what your goals and intent are. And that's what I really want to talk about. Assuming he even got no growth in his assets, or the growth he achieved in his $7.5 million retirement accounts just took care of his annual spending. So by time he turned 72, he still had $7.5 million. So there was either no growth, or one could say the growth just covered his annual spending and he spent it. Irrespective, under current rules, of course, they could change the rules over 12 years, his RMD, his first RMD, is going to be close to $280,000. So it's a substantial amount of money he's going to have to be removing. Certainly not the top tax bracket, though. So he's not looking. He never mentioned if he had a pension. He said he took a lump sum pension payout. So I'm assuming he doesn't have another job that has a pension. He never mentioned having any type of income annuities. So I'm assuming his only source of guaranteed lifetime income is probably going to be Social Security. So his distributions, Chris, assuming that's all he needs to live on, is the $280,000 in today's dollars. That would be coming out. Now, in the future, $280,000 isn't going to be quite the same as it is today. He might need more. But assuming reasonable growth on the brackets, he's not going to be in the highest bracket. So he's going to be, I don't have the actual breakdown. It's on my desk, which is 38 miles north of me where you are. But what the actual brackets are. But for a married couple,
I have the brackets
in
front of me.
What's 277? Is he still knee deep in the 24/28?
277, yes. The top of the 24 bracket for married filing joint in 2020 is 326.6.
So if they were to maintain the brackets around that amount, listener, you still might be kind of in the middle bracket. So what Chris is trying to say is, even with the RMDs, you still may be able to do conversion strategies. You may not have to jam them all in to just a 12-year period. You're still very young. I would definitely take advantage of the Trump tax cuts. And if they get extended, take advantage of those. But even when your RMDs begin, I still think you're going to be in the middle brackets. It may not be that high. Now, as you age, the RMDs are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, because the amount you have to take out increases. They're going to adjust these tables, folks, next year. So be prepared for that. They're going to adjust them in your favor. They're going to extend life expectancy. But I don't anticipate RMDs dropping more than 2, 3%. It's not going to be a massive reduction in the amount you're going to be forced to take out. Yeah. They just haven't updated their distribution table since 2000. So they're going to update them for current life expectancies, which will add a little bit of longevity to those tables, which will reduce the amount you're going to be forced to take out. But as you get older, folks, as you get into your 80s, your distributions start to exceed 5% of the account balance. And if his $7.5 million does grow, I'm assuming no growth, but if it did grow, that $7.5 million, and he did nothing proactive, he did no conversions or anything, that $7.5 million, Chris, even at a 3% return, would double in 20 years. So it can start to get quite large. And if the distributions, the percentage-wise, are rising to 5% and more of the portfolio, you can see his RMDs really into his 80s can get quite large. But what he's also concerned about, and maybe I'm misreading it, and you share what you think, Chris, because he mentions the Secure Act. Secure Act actually helped him by extending RMDs from 70.5 to 72. I think he's concerned with the Secure Act and passing what could be $7, $10, $12, $15 million to his children, where they are going to have to take it out, not over their life expectancies, but in a short 10-year period. And now that income is going to be taxed at the child's tax rate. And this husband and wife were both successful. I don't know if they were physicians. I don't know if they were attorneys or engineers or just really good at whatever it is they were doing. Obviously, they were really good at it because they amassed a lot of wealth. If their children are as successful, Chris, their children could be in that bracket, if not a higher bracket. And then those forced RMDs are going to push them even into higher brackets, causing a lot of the IRA to be lost in taxes. That's what I think he's worried about. Would you agree, or do you think I'm off somewhere?
No, I think that's why he brought up the Secure Act, was that fact that his kind of backup plan, if he wasn't able to do conversions, he wasn't super concerned because anything that was left over was going to be able to be stretched by his kids. And when they pulled the rug out from under him with the Secure Act, and that's why, that's kind of what prompted his reaching out to us for what other things might he do in order to prevent this ticking tax time bomb that could go off mostly for his kids in this particular case. But even for him, he's got some taxes to manage that during his lifetime, that doing nothing, if he just sat on this and didn't take much out, his RMDs would be enormous. So he's at least addressing some of his lifetime, his own lifetime tax burden with conversions, and he's got an early retirement, so hopefully he's got a nice big wide tax planning window that he's dealing with. But he pointed out something good or obvious to most of us who deal with numbers this big in retirement, so $7.5 million, unless you're spending a ton of money, you're almost for sure going to be leaving some behind. And when it's all trapped in these always taxable accounts, it is very ugly from a tax perspective, leaving it to beneficiaries these days with the Secure Act. So good that he's looking at it now, because a lot of this stuff you can't really fix retroactively. You've got to be proactive in this, make the projections, see what's coming down the road. They can always change the tax rules, obviously, but you can only make the decisions, the best decisions you can, given the information that's available, and always be looking, modifying what you're doing as they update the tax rules. But working on it immediately, as in now, for him, is a good idea, because if he waits too long, it's water under the bridge, you can't undo it.
Exactly. So let's look at a few other things, listener, and one that you haven't really mentioned. You might be thinking of it, but you didn't directly mention it, so I do. You did acknowledge your assets could grow quite high. And do keep in mind, if you want to protect those assets for your children and not just leave it to them where they might lose it to bankruptcy. Now, again, you and your wife both seem to be very successful. Your children may also be equally successful, and bankruptcy is not going to be an issue. So I'm not trying to scare you on that. But it is our duty to mention bankruptcy, creditors, or predators. Predators can be ex-spouses or could be anyone who's looking to try to take advantage of someone. But if your children could get exposed to something like that, your inheritance can be lost. The Supreme Court ruled, what is it, 2013 now, Chris, or 2015?
It's been a while now. Yeah,
it was unanimous. I nailed that one, right?
No.
Ah, jeez. Really? Seriously?
Seriously.
Oh, whatever.
You swapped out the M in the end.
All nine.
Everyone
agreed.
Knew what you meant.
I know, but you figure by now, you sure I did? Are you just messing with me? Unanimous.
No. No.
All right. All nine of the Supreme Court justices agreed that a inherited IRA does not receive bankruptcy and creditor protection. It is not a retirement account. Retirement accounts receive their protection from a law called ERISA and from state law. But the Supreme Court ruled that wasn't going to apply, and someone with a very large IRA that they inherited lost it to creditors. I forget what the gentleman's name was that had brought that suit, but it was major in our industry because it clarified you're not going to get the protections. Well, a trust can give protections. I'm not going to go too deep into the woods here on trusts, But that's how you get protections, is a trust. But the problem is, listener, remember what I said at the beginning of this show. You talked about your IRA accounts as an asset. You indicated you thought it was going to grow at 6%. You're managing the assets. You talked about a $3 million payout you're getting from your pension, coupled with $4 million, $4.5 million that's already in there. But you always talked about it in the term of an asset. You need to talk about it or think about it in the term of income, because it's IRD, income with respect to a decedent. And as Chris and I have said many times, trusts and IRD, in this case an IRA, mix like oil and water, or vinegar and oil. Not vinegar and oil, vinegar and baking soda.
Yeah, vinegar and oil is good. I put it on my salad. Yeah,
exactly. So I meant vinegar and baking soda. But do keep in mind, listener, if you're looking to protect the assets, you're concerned about the taxes, the income taxes your children may pay on the assets in light of the Secure Act and the fact that they're going to have to close this inherited retirement account and distribute it in 10 years. Now, don't forget, listener, I also feel the five-year rule is coming back. The original law, before it was changed to the stretch option, was inherited IRAs by non-spouse beneficiaries had to close in 5 years. And then they brought it back, and at least in the Senate, the sponsor in the Senate made it perfectly clear they're doing this as a revenue raiser, and they brought back the 10-year rule. How hard is it, Chris, in the future to just change 10 to 5? Not very hard.
No, they didn't have a lot of trouble changing it to 10.
Right, from stretch to 10, so it's not going to be hard to go from 10 to 5. And they do it for revenue because they know it's taxed as income. And it pushes people into very high brackets, and they can suck 30, 40, 50, 60% or more with state and local taxes as well. So it very well may turn into a five-year payout. Now, if you wanted to protect those assets in addition from taxes, but also from creditors, predators, and bankruptcy, most people would use a trust. And trusts work perfect with maybe taxable bank and brokerage accounts, never taxable Roths, step up in basis assets like homes and other real estate. Wonderful. Put them in a trust. They work wonderful, but not an IRA that contains IRD, income with respect to decedent, mixing with a trust, mixed, Chris, with a 5 or a 10-year payout schedule, and you can lose a tremendous amount of that wealth because trusts pay the highest marginal bracket, which right now, I forget, what is it, 37.
Mm-hmm.
After $12,950 of income. If every distribution from an IRA is considered income, and it is, you're going to have way more than $12,950 coming out of that IRA. Every dollar above that is taxed at the highest marginal rate. And then if you consider, or if the trust is subject, it may or may not, chances are it would be, but eventually, subject to the 3.8% Obamacare surtax, you're looking at a 40.8% tax bracket. And Lord only knows in the future, if the 10-year rule becomes 5-year rule and the marginal brackets the tax rates in the brackets are increased, and instead of being 37, it's 47 or 57 or 60% as the highest rate, you can lose an awful lot of that money. So now you can't mix, Chris, the IRA with asset protection, and you're also going to have to deal with income taxes. And there's one other thing he's going to have to deal with. What other tax haven't we talked about, Chris?
Well, estate taxes is on the table here.
Exactly. Estate tax.
Many, many people ignore those right now because the estate tax limits are high. They don't have to stay high. Those could easily be reduced. And he's got enough assets that if he does earn decent rates of return over a long period of time, he might end up having issues with the estate tax limits, even at current exclusion amounts.
I'm telling you now he will be. There is no way they're going to leave the estate tax rates at the rates they are now. There's just no way. They are going to go back down. I can't see it not happening. This government is too far in debt. The estate tax isn't going to impact 80%, 90% of people. It's going to impact most of our listeners. Most of our listeners are very successful do-it-yourselfers who have amassed millions, who did it as this gentleman did in tax-deferred accounts, only to realize later they just created a nightmare to themselves. But remember, folks, it wasn't too long ago. I was still just moving to Colorado when the estate tax exemption was only $600,000. And then it went to $1 million. And we thought, wow, $1 million. Now today it's $11 million and change, scheduled to go back to 5.7 at a single level, or 5.7 and change. I don't know the exact dollar amounts, on January 1st, 2026. But I don't think they're going to stay there. Many politicians on both sides of the aisle, I'm not picking on one party over another, but one particular party really is thinking this. They want to bring it right back down, Chris, to where it used to be, $1 million or $2 million. And I think this man could run into huge issues with estate taxes. And those taxes all work in unison, folks. It's not that you pay one or the other, the higher of the two.
Right.
You will be dead. You'll be passed away. But your beneficiaries will be forced, or the estate will pay the estate taxes. And then your beneficiaries have to pay the income taxes. And it can get ugly. There used to be, and what if this tax ever comes back, Chris? I don't know if you remember this. I remember it. I used to call it the success tax. It went by another name. But if your required minimum distributions were greater than this government limit, and this was right in the mid-90s when I was studying for the CFP exam, there was a 15% surtax.
Yeah.
If you had amassed too much money in your IRA...
I'd forgotten it as a bad memory, as a bad dream. I put it out of my mind.
That law got repealed right before I sat for the CFP exam, and I was so relieved because I couldn't quite understand how it worked all the time. But the case that got that law repealed, true story, folks, was a beneficiary who inherited money when his father or mother died, and he owed the government more in taxes, Chris, than he inherited. So he sued. Between the estate tax, the income tax, and the success tax, because the success tax applied to distributions from inherited IRAs, he owed more than what he inherited.
Yeah.
So he took the government to court. Now, tax court ruled in his favor, Chris. You know what the tax court said?
Well, you can't do that, for it can't be more than 100%, first of all.
Exactly. They can't take more than 100%. So he won. They couldn't force him to pay more than 100%. So I don't know if he won or lost, but the tax court said that, but it created such a hubbub, the government, Congress, got rid of the success tax, and they repealed it somewhere in the mid to late 90s. So could something like that come back in the future? We can't even fathom that. It might. One never knows what could come back, because this government is so far in debt. It's just laughable now, the amount of debt we have. So anyways, listener, don't forget the estate tax.
Yeah. We talk about the expiration of the Tax Cuts and Job Act, the sunset provision of, you usually call it the Trump tax cuts. Like we refer to it as Obamacare, because that happened to be the president in place who signed it when it went into effect. But the estate tax is slated to go, the exemption is slated to go back to the pre-2018 levels at the end of 2025. So that it automatically, now those limits were still quite high, but they're only about half of what we are at right now. So that's also pre-2017, so that would be pre-2018, the estate tax exemption was only $5.5 million.
Exactly. So what's he all to do? He is right when he wrote too many moving parts. That's the first thing to this listener and to all listeners who are falling into this category. And even if you don't have his level of assets, $7.5 million inside tax deferred accounts, even if you have half that or a quarter of that, a lot of what we're talking about may apply to you as your accounts grow and tax laws change. So do keep that in mind. So he mentioned the SGUL, Second to Die Guaranteed Universal Life Policy. He mentioned it by the initials. So it tells me, Chris, because you use an SGUL to benefit beneficiaries as a guaranteed inheritance, because it doesn't pay until the death of the second person. In this case, I assume it would be the husband and wife purchasing the policy, which would pay at the death of the second to die, hence the name Second to Die Guaranteed Universal Life Policy, and it would pay out money to the children as a guaranteed inheritance. But if structured properly, the life insurance is received income tax free. Now, Chris and I have addressed this on prior shows. Right now, and for as long as I remember, I don't think life insurance ever was subject to income taxes, but I could be wrong on that. But right now, life insurance is received tax-free. Now, Chris and I have pointed out ad nauseum, the life insurance lobby is one of the strongest lobbies in Washington. And that's why life insurance and annuities get these special tax treatments. Could that lobby ever weaken and the government come and start taxing life insurance? Yes. But I firmly believe, even though I have no proof they would do this, they would grandfather any life insurance policy, Chris, in existence prior to the passage of any law change that subjects it to income taxes. And I think you agree with that as well.
I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Mm-hmm. Correct, because people made massive decisions based on that assumption on how much insurance to buy, and then they turn around and change the rules and people can't get the insurance anymore. They really mess with people. So, I mean, politicians are idiots, I get that, but they're not that big of an idiot, I would hope. So our belief is if you put something in place with life insurance, I think you are permanently locking in, because you're buying it while it's still income tax free, you're permanently locking in an income tax free inheritance. You're also only 58 and 57. Assuming you're in reasonably good health for a 58 and 57 year old, relative to what you would pay in your 60s, 70s for a second to die guaranteed universal life policy, your premiums are going to be quite low. And what makes guaranteed universal life policies good in my eyes is that the word G, guarantee. The premiums will never change as long as you pay the premiums on time. If you're one day late or more, the policy can blow up. Not that it goes away, but the premiums will change. The guarantee on the premium will be lost. There'll be a new premium set, but you'll lose that original one. So don't be late on premium payments if you ever buy a SGUL policy. That's probably the biggest caveat I have to tell people. Don't be late on the premiums. Have it set up to come out automatically a week or two before the premium is even due from your checking account. But anyways, you would lock in tax-free money there, in my opinion. Then there is a strategy, and he referenced this strategy in the paragraph I didn't read, so he knows this. He asked, would he or should he own the SGUL policy in an islet? What do you think of that, Chris?
Well, definitely for estate tax preparation, that's a good idea.
Absolutely. Because what an islet will do, islet stands for Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust. And irrevocable means it can't be changed. But as Peter Scott always said when he was on the show, who is a not only a close personal friend, as everyone knows, he is a very knowledgeable tax attorney and estate planning attorney. An irrevocable life insurance trust is only irrevocable until you want to change it. A good attorney can put language in there that will make it not totally flexible like a revocable living trust, Chris, But you can change some of the provisions in an islet if it's set up correctly.
But the key with that, before you describe the islet more, let's remind people that the proceeds, the death benefit from a life insurance policy, gets included in your taxable estate. Even though
perfect.
The proceeds are not taxable from an income tax standpoint, they claw that death benefit back into what they call your taxable estate. So particularly in the future, if these estate tax exemption limit get reduced, some big SGUL policy that he purchases might end up being exposed to estate taxes. So that's where the islet comes in. We haven't heard a lot about islets lately because of the really, really high estate tax exemption limits. But if someone were to exceed those, or if those limits come down, we're going to start to hear more and more about the islet again. So
Right. Now
you can talk about what the islet does for you.
Thank you. I skipped over that part. That was a very good and a very important part to put in there. Islets were very popular, folks, when the estate tax exemption was $600,000 or $1 million. Now, all you do-it-yourselfers out there who have permanent life insurance, maybe $500,000, $1 million, $2 million of death benefit, do recognize what Chris just said. That is going to be clawed back into your taxable estate. So you might think, oh, no problem. Even if they change the laws, I've got $3 million in my IRA and I own a $500,000 house and I got $2 million in life insurance. I'm still going to be below the $5 million limit. Well, not really. And what if they lower that $5 million to $3 or $2 or $1? But that $2 million life insurance policy, unless it's owned in an islet, is going to get clawed into your taxable estate, combined with your IRA, combined with your $500,000 house. And now you can see, Chris, some of your estate might be subject to estate taxes.
Right.
So the way you get around that, folks, is you create, or you have a good attorney create, an irrevocable life insurance trust. We're not going to get deep into it on this show, or this show will become an eight-hour show. But we'll bring David back. David, the new attorney, the new Pete, if you will, is coming back on the show in a couple of weeks. And we already got some trust questions in for him. But maybe I'll bring him on after that show, Chris, and we'll do a whole show on islets.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into the nitty-gritties of islets. But at a 30,000-foot view, folks, the islet actually owns the life insurance policy. People die. Trusts do not. So do keep that in mind. So a trust can go on even after the life insurance policy pays out. And if the trust owns the life insurance policy, Chris, and not the person who died, it's not clawed back into their estate because they don't own it.
Right.
And when it's created properly, folks, even though the islet is doing what you specified and what you wanted and is insuring your life and receives money at your death, it's not considered owned by you. So at your death, even though the islet has nothing in it for the most part, it receives the premium payments every year for the life insurance, but then it pays the life insurance out the premiums. Even though there is nothing in the islet prior to your death, at your death, boom, $1 million or $2 million or $3 million all of a sudden appears in it, and it's dispersed to your children under the rules that you set forth in the islet. It's received income tax-free because it's life insurance, and estate tax-free because it's not owned by you, it's owned by the trust. And trusts never die. So there are no estate taxes due. The trust isn't dying. It's never dies. So it's received income tax-free and estate tax-free. Now, it could be pulled into future estate taxes if your beneficiaries die and so forth and they took the money out. But the attorney can get into that. I will have David get into that a little deeper. I'm giving you a 30,000-foot level here, folks, to understand how this works. So you could structure this in your 50s, listener. You're 58, your wife is 57. You could own it through the islet, recognizing a good attorney can make the ILIT quote-unquote changeable in the future if they put the right language in there, even though the word irrevocable is in there, but you could protect those assets from being subject to estate taxes. And those would be the assets or the death benefit of the life insurance. And then, of course, current laws protect them from income taxes, and I think you would be grandfathered in if that ever changes. So I like his thought process, Chris, with an ILIT and an SGUL to benefit his children. I'm hesitant on if he should be converting. And I know you might think that that's crazy. I would prefer he do a tax projection analysis, and those are growing in popularity, but it's hard to find advisors who do that. We happen to do it, but you can work with other advisors. I'd really like to see the numbers here, Chris, because I don't know what's more valuable. I have to really project those RMDs and see what it's going to look like. How much money does he have to take out irrespective to live on? If all his money is in always taxable accounts, what is his income tax burden going to be any year anyways? And will the RMDs, are they large, Chris, or are they excessive? He hasn't told us that yet. What's the difference between a large and an excessive RMD when it comes to tax planning?
Well, large, I mean, that's a subjective measure. You know, large to one person may not be large to another, but I can tell you when I see one. You know, they're just big. So large is one thing. Excessive means something specific. Excessive means you are forced to take out money as an RMD in excess of the spending you want to do. An RMD really, even if it's large, wouldn't even necessarily have to be considered an RMD if you would have had to take out the money to live on anyway. If you're spending the money anyway, it's actually irrelevant that there are such things as RMDs because you'd be taking it out anyway. It's when you are forced to take out money that you otherwise wouldn't spend. It's that amount above your normal intended spending levels that would create distributions that we call excessive. And we don't know. Jim's right. We don't know. By doing conversions now, would it really reduce the distributions that he takes out of his account in the future? That would be the goal typically with RMDs, is to suppress the future distributions. I'm sorry, the goal with conversions would be to suppress the size of the RMDs. But even if we suppress the RMDs by doing early conversions, if he's going to take out the full amount that he would have come out anyway just to live on, we haven't really accomplished a whole lot there. So that's kind of what Jim's getting at.
Exactly. Now, it may still make sense during the Trump tax cuts to convert, but post-Trump tax cuts, I don't know yet, listener, because you never told us. We know your RMDs are large just by the size of the amount of money. And as Chris said, large is subjective. A small RMD for one couple could be a large RMD, Chris, for another couple. But what Chris and I and you do-it-yourselfers need to be looking at isn't if your RMD is large. That's subjective. You want to look at the non-subjective. Is it excessive? If you need that money, if you're going to spend it, whether you're forced to take it out or not, it's not excessive. And then I question the value of conversions. If what you're trying to do is benefit your children, because getting money into the Roth, he has 95% of his money in always taxable accounts, Chris. He's got to be paying the taxes on these conversions from the conversions. So I'm not certain if he's truly optimizing what his children might be able to get. We might be able to defend doing it once we knew, or if we knew, what the future tax brackets for the children are going to be. But I'm thinking instead in my brain, would he be better off taking all the money that he was going to be spending on conversion taxes and plowing that money into a second to die guaranteed universal life policy? I don't know. but you might be able to guarantee, listener, $3, $4, $5, $6 million inheritance. I don't know, because I don't know your health. I don't know the numbers you're looking to do, but I do know a second to die guarantee universal life policy can be leveraged. And at your relative young age, you might be able to leverage it to a good amount. And it's not just looking at the amount of leverage you're going to get out of it, Chris. What if you only got 2 or 3 million out of it, not 6 or 7? But that's 2 or 3 million, 100% income tax free and 100% estate tax free. That might equal what a $6, $7, $8 million IRA would do after income taxes and after a potential estate tax. So I don't know. He's asking, what should we do? What you should do, listener, is get a tax projection. You might not need a retirement analysis, but you need a tax projection. You need someone who is going to be able to use some of the new tax optimization software that's coming out in our industry and be able to put a lot of these scenarios in there and show the various scenarios and the outcomes. What if income taxes rise? What in the future? What if they stay level? What if they drop? And start optimizing all these different scenarios, but also start looking at these broader strategies and don't knee-jerk reaction into a conversion. And instead start thinking, well, wait a minute. Why don't I remove income taxes, remove estate taxes, make the inheritance 100% guaranteeable, and do this through life insurance, which Ed Slott has called the eighth wonder of the world. And he points out ad nauseum, he doesn't sell life insurance. And unlike some talking heads in our industry, he doesn't receive payments from the life insurance industry to push life insurance. A lot of talking heads in our industry do receive payments from the life insurance industry to tout strategies. Ed doesn't. He simply knows what Chris just said. Chris didn't make up ticking tax time bomb. Where did you get that, Chris?
I think it originally came from Ed, but
Ed.
I heard it first from you as you brought it back from one of your elite program trainings. Yeah.
Yeah, his first book was talking about ticking tax time bomb, IRAs. That's what made Ed famous. And it is a ticking tax time bomb. But this strategy of using a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy coupled with an ILIT can remove income and estate tax risk and market risk. And rather than plowing the tax money to the IRS that you're going to have to pay on a conversion, maybe you just take out enough to cover the premium and you don't convert anything, especially if your RMDs are large, but not necessarily excessive relative to what you and your wife want to do with your money. All of your money is in IRAs. You're going to have to take some out of it. You haven't shared with us what your lifestyle cost. Did you amass $7 million but live on just $50,000 a year? That would be great. Or did you amass $7 million and you're used to living on $300,000 a year? So we have to look, or you, listener, have to look at that. And also don't forget, even if your IRA gets huge, if you have the ILIT and SGUL strategy off to the side that's going to guarantee completely income tax-free and completely estate tax-free and completely insulated from market risk, a $2, $3, $4, $5 million inheritance to your children. And we're not going to get deep into this because we talked about it on the past, but what could he do with that IRA, Chris? What kind of trust could he leave it to that would pay his children income in addition to that big lump sum of money they're getting from the SGUL?
Well, he could set up a charitable remainder trust that would be set up to pay to them. But even before you get to that complexity, I was going to say, if you've got this big life insurance policy that's going to pay to the kids, the fact that they might end up having to pay a lot of taxes on an inherited IRA might offset one another. So let me say that at first. But then you could also take the step that Jim is talking about, which is the IRA that's now left over that you haven't done all these big manipulations or conversions to, gets left to them. They're going to be subject right now to the 10-year rule, might be 5-year big old taxes. But if they don't need the lump sum amount net of those taxes, because particularly in this case where they just got a big life insurance payment, you could set that up into a charitable remainder trust, which is designed then to pay out, dole out money over time, much like the old stretch IRA. The only difference is at the end of the life of the charitable remainder trust, what's left has to go to charity for this to work. That's the name charitable remainder trust. It's not just an ordinary trust. But it will smooth out that tax burden, much like the old stretch IRA used to do. And remember, they got a big lump sum payment from the life insurance, so you don't have to feel bad that they didn't get a big windfall at your passing. They got some windfall in the life insurance, and then they also get the icing on the cake, additional income coming in yearly for a long period of time from this charitable remainder trust.
Right, and as Pete pointed out, it doesn't really work perfectly if you and your spouse pass away prior to your children reaching age 40. It works really well if they are 40 or older. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not going to get too deep. We have on prior shows about that strategy. Now, your other strategy, folks, as we wrap this up real quickly, he asked, what about gifting his children some money and letting them fund their Roths and their employer Roths? I like that with for any parent. You're allowed to gift money. What is it now, Chris? I think 15 or 16,000.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 16 now?
15 is, I believe. I think it's still 15 in 2020. The limit does increase. I'll check while you're talking in case we're wrong.
Okay. So you are allowed to give a certain amount of money to anyone, not just your children. And you and your spouse are married, obviously, so you can do a split gift. So each of you can gift that amount. So you're looking at $30,000 per child, $60,000 a year could go without you reducing your estate and gift tax exemption amount, which right now is quite high at 11 plus million. However, will be, I feel, dropping when the Tax Cuts and Job Act, otherwise known as the Trump tax cuts, expire, or as we've said on this podcast a few times, they revert back to older rules where the estate tax limits were quite low.
Yeah, the annual exclusion for 2020 is still 15,000.
15.
But it's probably going to go up shortly because it stayed 14 for 4 years from 2014 through 2017. But it's now been 15,000 for 2018, 19, and 20. So it's on the verge, probably, of making another $1,000 jump.
Increase. Yeah. A couple more years, it'll increase. So you could, and I have no problem with that, listener. I think it's a great idea. You don't have to wait until you die to see your children enjoy your success. And you want to help your children. Any money you give your children to help them fund, you mentioned their Roth 401ks and their Roth IRA. I don't know if your children will eventually be able to contribute to Roth IRAs. They may be making too much money, but the Roth 401k, they will be able to contribute to. Any money that you help them contribute to the Roth 401k is going to allow them to take that money that they would have had to take from their salary to put in there and use it for something else. Maybe to buy a house or help your grandkids by doing things with them as a family. I mean, it's just going to be additional monies that they can benefit from. So I love that idea. I also like his other thought, Chris, and that is name your children on the IRA form. Now you can already, I think he was talking about splitting his IRAs up and naming his children as primary beneficiaries. So when the first spouse dies, some of the inheritance goes to the children earlier. Kind of get that 10-year stretch out started on the first death and another one started on the second. I don't mind that, folks. However, it's kind of an irrevocable decision in the sense if you die after doing that and it turns out your spouse could have used that money, he or she won't have it. Instead, just probably do it the way you currently have it. I bet you you and your spouse have each other named as primary beneficiaries and your two children as contingent 50-50. That's what I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So what you can do is disclaim. Don't forget that strategy. All folks, not just this couple. When the first spouse dies, that surviving spouse could take all the money if they need it, disclaim the entire IRA if they don't need it, or disclaim just a portion of the IRA. In other words, they can figure out how much of this money do I need, how much don't I need? And the money they don't need, they can disclaim and pass on only to the named contingent beneficiaries. They cannot choose someone post-death of the IRA owner. It has to be whoever the IRA owner named as contingent beneficiaries. It's called disclaiming. It's perfectly legal. You get 9 months to disclaim. So rather than breaking your IRA into two or three small IRAs and naming some outright to your children, I would do it through disclaiming in case something is happening, Chris, who knows what, but something, and that spouse could actually use the money and not pass it on to the children. But if the spouse doesn't need it, they can disclaim. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
I like that, except in a case of blended families.
Absolutely.
The concern I have there is that the spouse might not disclaim simply to keep money from flowing to her or his stepchildren, which while married, they treat it as their own. But now that the blood parent is gone, they look out for themselves and their own blood related children. So that would be my only, that's kind of a pessimistic view of life, I guess, or of human nature, but that's the only curveball I would throw in there as consideration if it's a blended family situation.
Yeah, I don't think this family is, but you make a very good point for listeners who are in blended family situations. If you own the IRA and you got remarried and you have your spouse named as primary, and then you named your two children by blood on your IRA, it is possible what Chris is saying, that the spouse inherits it, and even if they didn't need it, they keep it and then change the beneficiary designations to their own kids and disinherit yours. So that's called blended family planning. I don't think that applies here, but Chris makes a very good point. If it does apply to you and that is a concern, then we have to look at other strategies than disclaimer planning. But I would rather you do it through disclaimer, listener.
I like the flexibility of it too.
Yeah, the flexibility. Chris and I are huge on flexibility. Longtime listeners will know that. Anything that allows you to keep making decisions before you get to that irrevocable pot, we like. So anyways, the final thing he asked, what about using term policies instead of an SGUL? This is pretty straightforward. I don't like it. Now, he did mention, how about term policies that will just cover us until I can get all these conversions done? Because he's thinking once everything is converted, everything is set to be inherited to his kids. I wouldn't dispute that. And if he's trying to help the kids deal with very large taxes before he can get it all converted, having a 10-year, 15, 20-year term policy could easily achieve that and allow him to provide liquidity for taxes if he dies and his wife dies during the conversion phase. And then once everything is in the Roth, the kids will inherit the Roth and that's it. However, if you like our ideas of trying to leverage through a second to die guaranteed universal life policy, which are always cheaper, you can't get...
Not necessarily cheaper than term. Cheaper than a single
that's what I
universal
meant,
life. Yeah, I single. Just wanted to clarify. I knew what you meant, okay. But for people listening.
And I don't believe you can get second to die term policies. I could be wrong on that.
I don't think we've found one yet, but they may exist in nature and we just haven't run across them.
They may be there somewhere. The reason you want a second to die policy over a single to die policy, it's always cheaper to insure two lives than one. so you can get much more leverage when insuring two lives. And if you're looking to pay out when your children inherit, and the children aren't going to inherit until the death of the second spouse, second to die policies work wonderful. However, if you're looking to use a second to die policy as the leverage, a term policy as the leverage for a guaranteed inheritance, I don't like using a term. You'd be able to buy a 30-year term at your age, listener, 57 and 58. That only takes you guys to 87 and 88. I wouldn't use it as the actual funding mechanism for the guaranteed inheritance to your children, because if you live one day longer than the term, it expires worthless. Mm-hmm. So do keep that in mind. I wouldn't like it as far as that goes. As far as your thought of buying it to provide liquidity until you can get everything converted, I can't dispute that, Chris. He has precious little of liquidity. 95% of his $7.5 million is in always taxable accounts. Granted, they are liquid, but they're not liquid on a tax-friendly basis. So if you wanted to provide some tax-friendly liquidity to help pay the income taxes, that strategy would work. But I really would encourage you to look at an ILIT and an SGUL and a charitable remainder trust and other strategies to truly leverage. Yep. And in closing, and Chris, I'll let you summarize as well, I think before he does any of the strategies that we mentioned, or even considers any of the strategies, he needs a forward-looking tax plan. That's what he needs.
Yeah, it's like going out on a trip without a map. Could you wander around and maybe get to your destination, even if you knew what the destination was? Possibly. But you can't start taking steps or deploying strategies until you know what the whole roadmap looks like. So, yes, I would be a big fan of him laying it out more broadly and with a more comprehensive plan focused on tax analysis before he starts strategizing and actually tactically doing anything in any way.
Exactly. And there are software programs out there in our industry that are growing in popularity. You should be able to find a tax-focused advisor that can help you do this. There may even be some tax-focused now forward-looking CPAs. You might look for a CPA / PFS. They'll probably be more inclined for that because they're a CPA who take a financial planning approach to their practice. You can go to firms like Chris and I's. This isn't a shout out to Just Us, but Bob, the CPA that we have, has some new software that we recently got him. And he's a kid in a candy store with that software. He just loves it. And it does a lot of what we're talking about. And it's going to allow you or the advisor you hire to help you put any number of forward-looking tax projections and compare one strategy to another and figure out what are we trying to do. And it's not just the strategy that allegedly has you die with the most dollars. Chris, you and I were talking about this just the other day with the software that Bob has, the amount of iterations it runs from a tax projection standpoint. And you pointed out a lot of these strategies, though, that it was recommending were so complex, it probably wasn't worth the less complex strategies that might have just made the difference, a couple of $100,000 difference between the very complex and the very easy strategy. So a good software will show you, yes, very complex strategies, but also very easy ones. And I would actually agree with you, Chris. I would favor the easy over the more complex. But that's what makes this my preferred recommendation. Do the projections first. Look at the strategies. Then start talking to people about putting these other more advanced plans into place, the ILITs, the SGULs, things like that.
Yep. Perfect.
Anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. That was a good topic, I think. So we really appreciate the idea. If you want to send in your own idea for an EDU show, the way to do that would be to go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. on the website. You can read a little bit more about us, learn a little bit more about the services that we offer if you're interested. And on there, there's also the contact form that allows you to reach out to us and send us an idea for a future EDU show, or ask us a question about a show that you've heard. Or if you have something that isn't as broad as an EDU show topic like today's was, if it's just a simple question, you can submit those on that same form. We can handle that during our other Q&A show that comes out once a week as well. So, Jim, hope you have a good weekend, and I will probably talk to you on Monday.
Alrighty.
Probably won't see you, but I'll talk to you.
Yep. I might come in on Monday. I haven't quite decided. Yeah, I'll be hiking Mount Audubon. Not Audubon. I'm doing St. Vrain next tomorrow. So depends how I feel on Monday morning.
Okay.
But I will let you know. But listeners, we will chat with you all next week with a new EDU and Q&A show.
Sounds good. Have a good weekend.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.